from the Samira Foundation, this is Demystifying NMO and MOG, where we bring together the world's foremost experts, the doctors dedicated to studying it, and the patients who live with it every day. With support from Genentech. Welcome back to another episode. I'm your host, Brian Dawson. Today we're honored to have Brian Koscheck of Mutual Aid Ambulance Service with us. Brian's a second-generation paramedic and a distinguished figure of the EMS community. He was named the Pennsylvania EMS Educator of the Year and has dedicated his career to improving emergency medical services. Brian brings a unique perspective to the table, not only from his extensive professional knowledge, but also from his journey as someone living with a rare disease. In this episode, Brian shares his expertise on how we can prepare for emergencies and ensure that local emergency plans can accommodate our needs. He also discusses the need for inclusive disaster planning that considers the unique needs of disabled individuals. We'll cover the rights of people with disabilities during emergencies and discuss the vital role of education and advocacy in bridging gaps and raising awareness. Whether you're a patient, caregiver, or someone involved in emergency management, we hope our discussion can provide a little insight and some practical advice. So let's get started. Here's my conversation with Brian Koscheck. Okay, well, I appreciate you stopping by and talking with me today. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Thanks for having me, Brian. My name is Brian Koscheck. I'm from Latrobe, Pennsylvania, and I'm currently a second-generation paramedic. I work at Mutual Aid Ambulance Service as a senior EMS education specialist in Greensburg. Prior to my illness, I worked as an operational background as a supervisor and administrator and started working in EMS back in 1998. My background growing up consisted of medical education, really inspired by my dad. My dad was one of the first paramedics in Pennsylvania, also a deputy coroner and funeral director. That kind of inspired me to go into the medical field. It kind of piqued my interest. Growing up, I played ice hockey. I played up into the club college level from high school, travel hockey. I also coached for many years after, before I got sick. So those are really the big things that we were able to do, or I was able to do growing up. As far as EMS, my interest at EMS, I really am big in EMS education. We like to see, increased communication strategies. I'm working on maybe adapting learning styles from our students to see how we can get the best educational learning experience out of them and really try to make them more high functioning and more critical thinking to be the best providers they can be. That's really my interest as of now.
I love seeing the focus on education and research and preparing EMS providers for what they're going to see in the field and for the opportunity to be able to prepare them to have an actual career in EMS. It's incredibly demanding on so many levels. So two things I did want to point out. You very humbly mentioned your interest in education, but you were named the Pennsylvania EMS Educator of the Year.
Yes, I was secretly nominated by our medical director, Dr. Jenkins, and administrative director, Jonathan Jenkins. And after consideration from other applicants, I was selected to receive the award last May. It was really interesting because I was caught off guard. It was a surprise ceremony from the Bureau of EMS. they actually came out here to Greensboro. We were doing a class for LECOM, an advanced cardiac life support class. And they stopped the class and did the ceremony in front of my family and some students and coworkers. So incredibly humbling experience. I didn't feel that I deserved it, but it's definitely an honor to receive that and to think about all the people that received it before. I'm honored to be mentioned with them. So it was quite a great experience.
Congratulations on that. It really sets up some of the other things that we're going to talk to about today and is just one part of why I was really interested in having you on the show to talk about emergency preparedness and what people with disabilities and chronic illness can do in disasters. Mm-hmm. And the second part of that was something that you had mentioned briefly was you had made the statement that you had gotten sick. Would you be willing to tell the listeners a little bit about that?
Absolutely. My journey with autoimmune disorders and immunology really began in the fall of 2017. I was lifting a patient into the back of an ambulance. It's a pretty routine thing that we do many times a day. And I felt a tearing sensation in my lower back. So for months, I was being treated for a traumatic injury, physical therapy and medications and whatnot. After months of deterioration and weakness, I was diagnosed with a disease called immune-mediated necrotizing myositis. So it is an autoimmune disorder that affects my muscles and primarily my proximal muscles. So the shoulder girdles and the upper arms, the legs and the thighs all become very weak and start to become necrotic. And really, the end result was severe weakness that was debilitating and put me in a wheelchair. So I'm unable to walk without assistance. Because of that, you know, I wasn't able to work clinically anymore. And that's whenever I transitioned into the education realm full time after that. One of the things also, you know, with the condition of myositis is one of the rare side effects is cardiac involvement. And unfortunately, my subset, I have what's called an SRP antibody, which is a very rare subset antibody of myositis that did affect my cardiac muscle. So giving the abridged version, I ended up with blood clots in my lungs and a weakened heart that resulted in cardiac arrest in 2021. I spent several months at UPMC Presbyterian recovering, and I can say that as of today, I'm in remission from my disease and continue my life as a cardiac arrest survivor.
That's just an incredible story, the beginning to end. We're so grateful that you were able to come through it. Thank you for sharing that.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
I think that really puts you in a great position as an EMS educator, because you're able to bring a different perspective to being able to provide care to people, not just with acute conditions, but with chronic conditions. So as an EMS educator, you teach EMTs and paramedics. Can you kind of give us an overview of what pre-hospital providers do?
Absolutely. Paramedics and pre-hospital providers are the highly trained providers responsible for the care and well-being of acutely ill and injured patients. Basically, what we do is usually outside of the hospital, they'll take care of the acutely ill and injured. Some of them do work in the hospital in a more controlled environment, but generally speaking, you know, they're handling advanced medical care outside of the realm of the hospital. Paramedics, they're trained to do all the aspects of what we call basic life support care. So first aid and splinting and CPR and whatnot. In addition to that, they're also trained in, you know, IV usage, multiple medications, reading cardiac monitors and treating, you know, different cardiac rhythms. So they are able to do most of the things and basically make the ambulance a mobile intensive care unit. One of the latest things that we're doing as far as paramedics is administering blood products, which is very important. It's the first time in history we were allowed to do blood outside of the realm of the hospital. So we hope that doing that is going to save even more lives and propel the profession in an even more positive manner.
Yeah, I had seen that. And as a bit of a disclaimer, I worked for Mutual Aid for a number of years as a paramedic, and it was fantastic to be there. And they've always been a leader in EMS education, and especially in the last few years. You've hosted great programs like the Emergency Medicine Journal Club. There's been an implementation of DEI element to the curriculum. And recently, you even offered training for your field staff on how to manage patients that have service dogs and what to do with the service dogs, which I thought was phenomenal. Are there other types of training that paramedics need to go through to help them be able to assist patients, especially patients with disabilities, during an emergency?
Yeah, that's a great question. Part of the curriculum, our curriculum is over 1,000 hours, which includes classroom and, laboratory and field training out in the field. Honestly, there's only 4 hours of scheduled time for cognitive and physical disabilities. So what we try to do, being in my condition, I'm the content expert in our education department on physical disabilities. So I try to spin every type of subject that we do and kind of incorporate physical disabilities into each subject. So for instance, if we're talking about, someone having chest pain or with acute coronary syndrome or maybe a respiratory problem, not only does the students have to figure out how to critically think through, the situation and the presentation in front of them, but also how would they extricate the patient? What kind of questions would they ask? Medicine isn't just doing the medicine, it's also the people involved. It's communicating with the patients, communicating with families, and also having an exit strategy. If you look at the star of life, which is our symbol for EMS, one of the sides of the star is for, transportation. And we have to be able to find ways to get people out of situations, whether it's a vehicle or their residence or wherever they're at. So we do try to do that. I think that was overlooked in years past, and for no fault of anyone's own, it's just something that wasn't brought to the forefront because it wasn't something that we noticed as a problem. And now that that I am in the education department, we do see that. We try to implement that more than just the 4 hours that we normally do teaching that to the specialty classes.
So you've really been able to take it and incorporate it throughout the program. So it's not necessarily just a focused block.
That's correct. In all levels too. We offer going back to what you mentioned, the DEI training. We have to look at the population from outside of our own point of view. I think a lot of us are very limited with our experiences growing up, some biases that we might have, or things that we're not real familiar with, and be able to expand that. Inclusion is very important with all of our patients, that all patients feel that they're being taken care of appropriately, and that we have a basic understanding of the needs of the patients, whether it's for physical or cognitive reasons or religious reasons or whatever the problem might be. We need to be able to accept everybody and treat them appropriately. And that starts with education. And it really opened up my eyes to some things that I didn't know about in our DEI training, the service dog training, and the new implementation of the book club was really good because it brought people out to speak and to communicate with each other. And living in the world, I have a 12-year-old, so I know what it's like to live in a world of texting and faces in the phone. And the face-to-face communication may not be there now. We're trying to open that up again. We want to make sure that people are able to look someone in the eye and communicate, make their needs known, and close that loop of communication so we do the best patient care possible.
We always hear about being prepared and planning for emergencies, but when you start thinking about it, where to start, it can be really overwhelming. So where does a person start to begin that process?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's overwhelming for, and I will use the term normal, but for the average person that doesn't have disabilities, to prepare and plan for an evacuation. If you think about it, we've been really trained our whole life, with doing that from a young age of fire safety and maybe first aid or just regular safety. All of that comes into play. Whenever someone is disabled, you really start to think about the basics. And when I mean the basics, it's the things like, how am I going to get out of bed? How will I get out of a chair? If my house is on fire or there's a flood or I need to evacuate a vehicle or a house, how will I do that? And that becomes much more daunting because most people, it's intrinsic. They just stand up and walk away. It's a little more difficult for us. The one advantage I think we do have is that we have time to think. I know, sitting in a recliner for many hours a day, especially at the onset of my illness, I would think of these things. In the event of a fire, how do I get out of my house? What do I do with my dog? I need to make sure my kid gets out of the house. So those are things we have to think about. And really, the problem solving didn't just exist with me, it existed with everyone else in my family. So I involved my son, I have an older son that's not at home, but my younger son, he was definitely involved. My wife, other family members, all got together and made a plan. And whether the plan is written out or at least is talked about, I think the important thing is preparedness. First thing we have to do is establish what could be or what could the problems might be, and then have a solution for those problems. And all of those problems and solutions that we might have for it, I think, are different and individualized for everybody. But the first step starts with having a plan, identifying a problem, and then trying to work it out.
When I had gotten sick, and once I had finally been released to go back to work, we had a fire drill the one day. This was like months later. And at this point, like I had just stopped walking with a cane, finally starting to venture out. And I was sitting in my office, and there was a fire alarm. And one of the guys that worked with me, he stopped at my door. He's like, "You ready? I've been assigned as your escort to make sure you get out." And I'm like, "What are you talking about?" It wasn't even something that had occurred to me, but in the emergency management planning, this was something that they had taken into consideration, whether he physically had to assist me or if he had to extricate himself and then
Right.
report back that, "Hey, Brian's trapped in the stairwell or whatever."
Right.
So, like you were saying, that taking that community approach to it and having
Right.
everybody involved in the planning is really important. And it was
I
a real
agree.
eye-opener for me too.
That's interesting. That's really a neat story.
Yeah. In regards to preparedness, you have your plan in place. What about supplies when you're looking at whether you have to shelter in place or evacuate? Are there special considerations that someone with disability needs to keep in mind?
That's a great question because, again, the thing is individualized to everyone's own medical history. I can speak for myself. I know that I take multiple medications daily. I make ensure that I have meds stocked for at least a week just in case I'm not able to get it. Some meds, I'm on Eliquis. It's a blood thinner for patients with cardiac arrhythmias, and it's a lot of times overprescribed. Sometimes there's a supply and demand issue, and it's hard to get. So, one thing to make sure first that I think medications and things that keep people alive, oxygen and other pieces of equipment that they use daily to maintain the daily life and comfort should be definitely taken into consideration. As far as adaptive equipment, I use a wheelchair. I have extra batteries, I'm ready to go. I make sure I have a lift. It's kind of like a Hoyer lift. It's called a Rift and Tram. I have extra batteries as well, so if the power goes out, I'm able to at least use those devices for a few days in the event of that. But really, when you're making a plan, it's to think, what do I use on a daily basis that A is life sustaining to make sure that I'm able to survive and keep going, and number two, convenience issues. What are things that I use to maybe help make my life easier? And adaptive equipment is one of those things. So those are the two main areas I think we look for whenever you're looking for supplies or maybe something to stock up on in the event of an emergency.
That makes a lot of sense. We've talked about we have a plan in place and we have supplies, but are there any classes or is there anything that a person can do to educate themselves and or even be able to assist others in an emergency?
Great. I think from a professional standpoint, the first link of the chain of survival, and we look at the American Heart Association model, is recognizing there's an emergency and making the initial call for help. And it's you wouldn't believe that people that maybe wouldn't recognize what an emergency is, or they're unsure of what to do or how to call. The first step is to think, is there an emergency, and how do I get help, or who do I get here to help somebody in the event that I'm unable to do that. Really, first aid classes, we have stop the bleeding classes that occur. CPR classes are great, and they're wonderful ways to get the public and the general lay person who are not medically trained initial access into what we do in the emergency field. We want to make sure that when the ambulance arrives and their paramedic or an EMT comes out of the ambulance, that we have a viable patient that we can possibly help or save. And that starts from the community, recognition of an emergency. And also, quick acting and contacting 911, I think those are pretty important things. From a personal standpoint, that recognition of quick recognition, and early CPR and providing first aid literally saved my life. Because of this, I can say that I'm a cardiac arrest survivor and not just a cardiac arrest victim. So first aid training and CPR are paramount, and that really, I implore everyone that's able to go out and try to the best of their ability, whatever their ability it is. To get that initial training to help others.
Absolutely. We see stories in the news every day about how the actions of people that have basic first aid, CPR, stop the bleed training are saving lives. So it's an incredibly important link in that chain of survival. Earlier you had mentioned about life in the digital world, and it's truly a world of information overload. So how do we stay updated? We have so many sources of information that are coming at us all the time. How do we find like emergency alerts and reliable information during an emergency?
Yes, that's true. Because sometimes, in social media is one of our biggest forms of alerting people, and it's not always correct. And we need to make sure it comes from a reliable source. There are visual and audible warning devices. So if you're difficulty hearing or difficulty seeing, traditional alerts may not work for them. So there are adaptive technology that will work. I've learned through, in my case, the Office for Vocational Rehab or OVR. They establish some things that we have in place for myself. That they will do that. So they will install an app on the phone, for instance, that allow a different warning sound, maybe at an audible that's higher than usual, so someone can hear it if they're difficulty hearing, or vibrations that might alert them in the event that they have difficulty with visual acuity. So there are different ways you could be alerted for, which is great. It's finding the resources to do that. Whether you speak to your family doctor or someone who is familiar with adaptive equipment. That is possible to get that so they could be up to date in making sure that they're safe during an emergency.
I didn't realize that. That's really cool. I'm going to transition a little bit into the response aspect of an emergency, as things are happening. In terms of having to evacuate or go to an emergency shelter, for someone with disabilities, is this something that we need to be working with a local emergency managers in regards to and making sure that they are able to accommodate certain needs that we may have? So what does that look like in finding those shelters and being able to make sure that it works?
Yeah, that's a great question. One of the things, everyone is required to follow ADA compliance. So after 1992, Buildings and structures built after that should be ADA compliant. The issue is that if it's older buildings or maybe something that's before those compliance issues occur, we see some barriers to compliance. So there may be some issues with sidewalks and entrances into those buildings, maybe sleeping arrangements in areas that don't have the ability to have a wheelchair to be moved around, and doing a 3-point turn with larger equipment. So there are considerations to be taking place. Our local EMA directors, every township and city and local areas does have them. They are readily available. If you go on any county or local website, you could find the EMA director and their information on there as well. Really, you can even call the fire department or a local non-emergency like 911 or police number to find out who they are and to reach out to them. But we should be working with them. I work closely. I worked in Unity Township for many years at Arnold Palmer Airport as an EMS supervisor, and I work closely there with our the multi-agency communication center, the MAC center up there in the Unity Township EMA director. So we have had many discussions over the years prior to my illness and afterwards about what might be needed, and I think that really opened up their eyes a little bit to maybe that the evacuation plans and plans to shelter patients is good for the majority of patients, but not necessarily for all patients. And I think that's or individuals. I think that's where we're kind of leaning towards now. What are different ways we can accommodate them and make sure that they're in a safe place, in a safe manner for a temporary place like a shelter?
And the other side of that virtual world that we exist in is the technology. Is there technology that's being utilized to improve emergency responses for people with disabilities?
Yeah, I think technology is always evolving, and it is there with that. We do have voluntary registries like locally for patients who may have disabilities. Interesting enough, our dispatch center, if patients call in and maybe give door codes or sports locations of spare keys or things like that that might be able to help our responders in an emergency situation, that's kind of important. So there is technology available for that. It's the utilization of the technology that's kind of the barrier. If you are elderly or unfamiliar with some of the technology that might be there, it could be difficult. I know when I was in the hospital, I was had a tracheostomy. I was on a ventilator. I had a lot of difficulty communicating. I was using text-to-talk technology, which really helped make my basic needs known. And for somebody who's unable to communicate their needs, it's not the big things. It's always the little things that matter, the comfort measures and things that you may be scared about or to alleviate fear. That's pretty important. So if the technology is available for someone to use, whether it's TTY technology, the text-to-type, whatever you have available for you, I think it's great to use, and we should be able to educate people to use that to help them with their daily life during an emergency.
Absolutely. And of course there's always that double-edged sword, so to say, of technology and emergencies is the risk of equipment failure or the infrastructure, broadband's down, power outages and things of that nature.
It's interesting you say that because, and you're right, it does happen from a time as a teenager, I became an amateur radio operator. So we're able to provide communication between emergency services using battery operated radios. So we don't rely on electricity and other factors. So we do a lot of direct communication and repeater usage to communicate. So we're able to really establish communication between possibly reaching patients, rescuers, providers, and the hospitals and shelters from there. So there are ways to get around it. In the event of a complete failure of technology, we do have some, I don't want to say archaic, but some older things we're able to do to try to keep that communication going. And that's something really, if you people might ask, how can I get involved, or what are some ways I can help? You can operate a radio from a wheelchair, and that's something that we can use. Very important. I know all of our air shows and all of our large disaster events and our scaled disaster responses that we do implement our amateur radio operators with us. So they're a key component to disaster management and mitigating the some of the factors that can be detrimental to rescues and operations.
I remember I was preparing some documents about specific apps that can be used for during emergencies. And one of the things that I had never realized was the app not having to be online or connected to the internet and the functionality of it. And so there's little things like that, like you said, you have to take into consideration to be prepared for. So excellent, all excellent points. You also talked about someone in a wheelchair, they can be involved by working in communications or something like that. Are there opportunities out there for people with disabilities to be involved in disaster planning? And how would someone go about even getting started or getting involved?
Yeah, that's a great question. The first place to step would be probably your local, fire department or EMA agency. They would be able to lead you to that direction. I've had people that, ask me, well, you're in a wheelchair and you are involved with emergency services, what are you capable of? And that's one of the things that I do. During an emergency, I would be involved with communications. More of that side of the logistics side, not the operation side. So it's important. A lot of the behind the scenes things occur because of that. And that's necessary to do that. Someone needs to organize, someone needs to be able to lead and take charge and bridge the gap between the people in the offices and administrative aspects and operations as well. So there is opportunity for that. And really, we're just trying to maximize our abilities with what our disability might be. People always say that disabled people are just able differently, and that's absolutely true. I found things in my life that have kind of come up because of advantages because of being disabled, and you have to look at it from a positive standpoint. So if you really want to be involved and you are disabled, there are ways they can find to do that. Really, I would think the biggest thing we do is education and advocacy, just letting people know that we are available, that we're here, and sharing some of your stories of your individual needs really opens the eyes of people that may not be in your shoes. I see the world from a whole different perspective of being a disabled person now than before. So, being involved in EMS still, I see things a little differently and, can provide some insight. And that's what people can do with disabilities, is provide insight and advocate in the event of an emergency.
Great points. Are there any specific policies or legislation that's in place to protect the rights and the safety of people with disabilities during emergencies?
Yeah, all evacuation plans and emergency planning is, they have to be ADA compliant with that, which is very important. And that's one of the big things we're looking at to protect people with disabilities. We're not just looking for, with education and other aspects with employment, but in an emergency, we have rights just like anybody else. And that's really what we're looking for. And most people do comply to that. There are some gray areas where people aren't familiar with all aspects of ADA. Those really occur during the non-emergent phase. During an emergency, as all bets are off, right? We plan to do whatever it takes to tell people with that. So, when we look at somebody who's in a wheelchair or disabled or might have a need with that, they are definitely taken into consideration along with able-bodied people. And when we do our assessment and treating and transporting, so, we do follow that policy of the ADA from behind the scenes. It's really pretty important. At the federal level, FEMA appointed a disability coordinator in 2010, which I thought was a really interesting thing. Someone, liaison that can kind of bridge the gap between the disabled community and, the administrative policy policymakers for that, really giving them some insights. So, prior to 2010, they didn't have that direct connection. It was all done in, without a direct connection to that. So I thought that was pretty important with that. Locally, with the EMA agencies and emergency planning, I think the thing is the unawareness. Most EMA coordinators and EMS providers, we do have policies in place to protect everybody as a whole, but not necessarily the specifics for someone with a disability. That really is lacking, and that's something that we need to look for in the future to kind of shore up.
Even though there may be gray areas or some gaps that do exist, it's a matter of trying to communicate what our needs are as a community of people with disabilities and trying to help address those. I'm sorry, go ahead.
That's okay. It's interesting that Pennsylvania has more, statistically, we have 13% of our population is disabled. So if you're on the ambulance, you have a pretty significant chance statistically of finding someone who's disabled and treating them. And so for a, going back to the education realm, for a 4-hour block of education, that statistically 13% of our patients could have some sort of disability. I find that there's a gap with that. And it comes back to awareness and education, really. I think there are policies in place that are great, but if the policies aren't followed, or if you're unaware where to find the policies or how to follow the policies, that's where there are errors that might occur. That's where the gaps, I think, occur.
And as you mentioned, once you get into an emergency situation, the unpredictability of an emergency really makes preparation, preparedness, and practice a very important part to be able to learn how to do the things we need to do to take care of ourselves while under stress is really an important skill to develop.
That's a great point. I know our crews are trained. We'll use in the event of an emergency, they have to evacuate someone in a wheelchair. We are expert movers of people. So a lot of times they call us. We're transport specialists. That's what we do. So we are absolutely trained to take a patient who is disabled, no matter what the issue is with disability, to lift them up appropriately without hurting them, place them on a stretcher, and transport them to a destination. The problem is, what happens once they get there? A normal ambulatory person would be able to stand up and walk and move around, where someone like myself would need to have that equipment available at the receiving facility or a shelter or wherever I'm being evac'd to. So those are the considerations I think that come into play. It isn't so much the emergency itself, but what happens afterwards. And that comes back to that preparation. You always have to think 3 steps ahead, kind of help those providers as well. If someone comes to take me to the hospital, I need to ensure that I educate them on my needs. What I'm going to need beyond just the initial care that they're going to treat. Maybe they would realize then that there are people like me that they have to start considering beyond just the what's in front of them and think about what happens into the future.
It's really great insight. What do you envision the future of emergency response and management in terms of inclusivity and accessibility? Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I have thought about it. I really found that it's just a lack of awareness, and I really believe that it takes somebody to give a voice to the voiceless and those that don't know what to do. And when it comes down to emergencies and preparedness, it isn't that the people that these leaders the leadership doesn't want to; it's that they don't know where to start or where to begin. And most people, aren't going to reach out and ask. They're not going to say, "Hey, Brian, you're in a wheelchair. Can you come talk to me about these policies?" A lot of people just don't want to do that. They're afraid to ask, or they're embarrassed, or just don't want to bother with that. Really, it takes someone that has firsthand knowledge of these issues that might occur to bring to light some of the problems that we see and expand that. I would like to see policies in place that are addendums to our current policies of regular evacs and rescue operations for disabled patients, possibly for the cognitively impaired, definitely the physically impaired, because we deal with that with extrication. And then add these specific things in, maybe what to do with assistive devices, how to transport them appropriately, and whatnot. Just like the service dog, I think that we had, right? We talked about that. So we want to make sure that we educate people and put into these policies written policies that people can tangibly look at in black and white, and say, hey, in case of emergency with someone who's disabled, these are things we're going to do, and it is now officially part of the emergency plan. And I think that's important to have.
Absolutely. You were talking about the lack of awareness is often the greatest barrier, so to say.
I look at that from the standpoint of where we're at. We did our sidewalk, the city, and they have the cut in the curb, and it's really nice. But they put the alert system where you hit the button for the walk button right in the middle, so you can't get a wheelchair around it. And I told my wife, I said, interesting that they should have consulted with someone in a wheelchair maybe before they did that. You could tell somebody, and I say that all the time, is maybe they should have talked to a disabled person before they did this. We need to have that voice, and that's part of the thing, and especially with the rare diseases. I mean, really, there isn't many of us. Our sample size is so small. Research, no one throws money at a sample size of 30,000 people worldwide, right? So, all of my treatments, and I'm sure with yours as well, off-label use, multiple denials with insurance.
Yep.
Nothing is really, but actually, what put me in remission was Cytoxan, which is a cancer drug. It's a chemo drug. Nothing to do with myositis at all, right? But that's what worked, and that's what saved my life. So it's so interesting that, had there been more people or more advocacy or more money allocated at something like this, we can save more lives. But we need to definitely have a voice and make ourselves known with the small community that we have.
Right. Are there any upcoming projects or initiatives that aim to improve emergency services for people with disabilities?
At the national level, there's always things coming up at the national and state level. Nothing specific as far as helping people with disabilities at that level, but locally, there is local interest in advocacy for local EMA directors. So I've met with our leadership here with our Special Operations Division, and they're definitely interested in doing it locally. My hope is that once we start changing some things locally, get some things written on paper, and we have that black and white in front of us, that we could take it to the next level, to different levels, maybe regional, like county levels, and then work our way up from there. So really, it starts from the grassroots effort of a local ability to make changes, and then work our way up from there. So we're hoping to start small here, start raising awareness and advocacy, and work our way up from there and try to help people at a global level.
Considering the role that you and your organization have taken in EMS education and building better communication systems, I think that the hopes of many people within our community are in the right hands, and I think you're going to be very successful with it. So I definitely appreciate the work and the support from your company in allowing you to really dig into this topic and improve the lives of so many people.
Oh, thank you.
Is there anything that we didn't touch on or anything that we might have missed?
First of all, thank you for bringing me on. You having a platform that you have to send these messages like this to people that maybe wouldn't have normally heard it, I think is very important. And I didn't realize how important advocacy was. I did a presentation for EMS providers at EMS last weekend, as you're probably familiar with. And I did it on advocacy because my life was saved by healthcare professionals that advocated for me. And I really take that to heart. So I really think that awareness that you're spreading really invigorated me to try to help more people at my level here, and maybe and definitely inspired me to move on, maybe to advocate for others. So it's always good to educate yourself and arm yourself with new things and new tools to help people and better the community and have better patient care.